It's certainly good to see everyone again this morning. I want you to know we appreciate your presence, especially if you're visiting with us. And just noting that this is the first time that we've had our new schedule of services, just in case anyone who's visiting might be wondering why we're doing this. We have a number of our own members that live quite far away from the building. It makes it a bit easier for them to order their day, as well as the possibility that some who might otherwise, for example, in the winter, not be able to come to the evening service and such, we're going to have it all in the morning. And I think it's gone well up to this point in time. Grateful for the fact that we've had this opportunity to come together and to worship God. And I hope and pray that what I prepared again this morning is going to be beneficial for your consideration. I would like you to turn with me in your Old Testaments to the book of Nehemiah. We're actually going to spend the majority of our time in the 13th chapter, chapter 13. Had Monty read the text of Nehemiah chapter 1 to serve as a type of introduction to us, just to note exactly what the book is about, and that is the rebuilding of Jerusalem. The children of Judah had been conquered by the Babylonians and had been taken away into captivity, and as a part of that judgment of God, Jerusalem had been destroyed. The captivity lasted for almost two generations, a period of 70 years. In that interim, Babylon had fallen and the Persians had taken over as the rulers of both Israel as well as most of the world at that time. And the man Nehemiah that is mentioned in our text in Nehemiah chapter 1 and going through the book served as a very important individual in the court of the Persian king. Persian king's name was Artaxerxes, and Nehemiah served as his cupbearer. He was a very important individual in the court, privy to some of the most considerations and ins and outs and goings on of the kingdom, and in fact was given the responsibility to drink the wine or the drink before the king to ensure that it was not poisoned. So it was considered a fairly important position in the Persian kingdom. And so he had these interactions with the king. The book of Nehemiah begins with his petition to the king to be allowed for a period of time to return to the land of Israel and to rebuild the city walls of Jerusalem. And the king granted him that permission, and so a remnant of the people began to rebuild the wall. You'll note as you look at the books of Ezra as well as Nehemiah that the rebuilding of the wall and the beginnings of the rebuilding of Jerusalem were done in the face of great opposition. And among those who opposed them was the leader of the Ammonites, a man by the name of Tobiah, who had made alliances with some of the Jewish nobles that had preceded Nehemiah to the land. And so he had a position of influence even among the Israelites. We are told that Nehemiah became governor, that he had authority over the people for 12 years during this time in which the wall was being constructed surrounding Jerusalem. And during his tenure as the governor of the people, could not be a king because they were under the auspices of the Persian Empire, he accomplished the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem, which brought a great deal of joy and a sense of purpose back to the nation of Israel. He had a census done, which restored the people in the registration to their proper genealogy. He had Ezra read the law to the people of Israel, bringing about a repentant state among the people. That's related in chapters 8 and 9 of the text. And then we are told at some point in time he left, and he returned to the court of Artaxerxes. And we don't know how much time he spent away before returning to Jerusalem. But while he was away, some things began to fall apart. Among them, that alliance that we referred to with regard to Tobiah the Ammonite. While Nehemiah was away, the priest, Eliashab, had granted to Tobiah an Ammonite a large storeroom in the temple courts. Now this was in violation of the law of God. And so when Nehemiah returned, he found out about this treachery, and this brought into position and to play a series of reforms that are mentioned in the 13th chapter of the book of Nehemiah. There are actually three reforms that Nehemiah made at that time, and we want to note those three things, and then we're going to make some applications as we consider them. So I want you to begin reading with me in chapter 13 and verse 6 of the passage. The first reform that we want to note has reference to Tobiah the Ammonite, who had that storeroom in the court and who was cast out by Nehemiah. You'll notice in chapter 13, verse 6, we're told that this is in the first person, Nehemiah speaking about what he did. He said, "After certain days I obtained leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem, and I discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. It grieved me bitterly." And one of the things that I want you to note in these readings is the amount, the nature of the emotion that Nehemiah showed, because it's an indication of his great zeal as a servant of God. He said, "It grieved me bitterly, and therefore I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room, and then I commanded them to cleanse the rooms, and I brought back into them the articles of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. I also realized that the portions for the Levites had not been given them, for each of the Levites and the singers who did the work had gone back to his field." One of the things that you might remember with regard to the allocation of the land to the various tribes of Israel, that the Levites were not given a portion of land. In fact, they were to be paid from the tithes that were offered up as a part of the remuneration that the people of Israel were to give back to the Lord. The Levites and the priests were to be paid or to gain their wages from those offerings that the people had given. But the Levites here, they were not being paid. It became necessary for them to go and get some land and to work the land themselves. And so he said in verse 11, "I contended with the rulers and I said, 'Why is the house of God forsaken?' And I gathered them together, set them in their place, and all Judah brought the tithe of the grain and the new wine and the oil to the storehouse. And I appointed as treasurers over the storehouse Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, and of the Levites, Pedaiah, and next to them was Hanan the son of Zachar, the son of Mathaniah, for they were considered faithful. And their task was to distribute to their brethren." So this is what he did. First reform, kicked out Tobiah and made sure that the Levites who were not getting paid received what was their due, set faithful men to that task. Now I want you to notice what he says in verse 14 of the text. He says, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for its services." So he was asking for mercy from God, that he be remembered by God as a result of the good deeds that he did in this regard. That's a pattern that you see throughout this particular chapter of the book. So if we go to the next reform that is mentioned in the text, beginning in verse 17 of Nehemiah chapter 13, you'll notice here that the Sabbath was not being observed by the people. The people were working on the Sabbath day. Notice in verse 17 of chapter 13, he said, "I contended with the nobles of Judah." And again, you'll notice it was the leaders of Judah who were not doing their work with regard to paying for the Levites. And it was the priest himself, Eliashib, who had dealt treacherously with regard to the house of God and allowed Tobiah the Ammonite in. And now it is again the leaders of the people. "I contended with the nobles of Judah, said to them, 'What evil is this that you do by which you profane the Sabbath day?'" He said, "Didn't your fathers do this? And did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on this city? Yet you bring added wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath." Now I want you to note, he said, we are in the state that we are in right now. They had been taken away into captivity. They had spent that generation in captivity, and now they return to Jerusalem and the walls had been destroyed. The city was nothing. All of this was because of the rebellion of Israel, and now here you're doing it again. And so we are told that he posted some of the servants at the gate. Well, let's start back at verse 19. "It was at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, that I commanded the gates to be shut and charged that they must not be opened till after the Sabbath." On the Sabbath day, the gates would be shut. No commerce would be ongoing. Now we are told there, I posted some of my servants at the gates so that no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath day. And the merchants and the sellers of all kinds of wares, they lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. So saying that they're getting out there outside the gates. They're wanting in. They do this once or twice. But notice what he says to them. He says to them, this is Nehemiah, again indicating his great zeal. He said, why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. From that time on, they came no more on the Sabbath day. I just like the matter-of-fact way that's said. You do it again, you get in trouble. You do it again, I'll lay hands on you. You didn't do it anymore. And that's just an indication that if there is a will and a desire to serve God, there is enough conviction on the part of the righteous to serve God that it will gain the day, that we can attain the victory if indeed enough of us are willing to do what is right. And so in verse 22 he said, I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves, that they should go and guard the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. And then again he said, remember me, O God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of your mercy. Now, we understand just how serious a crime it is, the failure to observe the Sabbath. It was a serious thing that brought God's reproach upon the people, and so he made this second reform. The third reform is mentioned in verses 25 through 31. Among the things that the Israelites had done, the men had taken women of other nations. The people of Judah had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And it distressed Nehemiah that half the children had reached the point where they couldn't even speak Hebrew. They could only speak the language of Ashdod, or one of the other peoples. I want you to notice again the language that is used in verse 25 to 13. Going down through verse 31, he said, I contended with them, I cursed them, I struck some of them, pulled out their hair. I made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Did not Solomon, the king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women? One of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. He said, I drove him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. And thus I cleanse them of everything pagan. I assigned duties to the priests and the Levites, each to his service, and to bringing the wood offering, the first fruits at appointed times, and then finally, the final time, remember me, O God, for good. So looking at this example that Nehemiah gave about Solomon, again, we understand that the pagan women had turned his heart away from God. This, again, is a dangerous thing. And so Nehemiah's anger, his indignation, his reaction is something that is not only understandable, but as we see in the context, it is commendable to God as he sought to bring the people back to him. And he said a final time, remember me, O God, for good. Now, what applications can we make in regard to this? There are four applications that I want to make note of concerning these three reforms, and then finally the statement that he made on three occasions at the end of each reform. First of all, we want to emphasize that evil companions can cause you to sin. We are told that Eliashib, which was the priest of Israel, priest of Judah, an individual whose responsibility it was to be the spiritual leader of the nation of Judah, this man had brought an Ammonite into the temple courts, allowed an Ammonite to defile the temple courts. Now this was a violation of God's law as mentioned in the text of Nehemiah chapter 13. And we notice in Deuteronomy chapter 23 where that law actually is given. In Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 3, this is the command from God. An Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the tenth generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because They did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt. And because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. That's the reason. And this was a commandment. And it was for 10 generations. It was forever. It would never be that an Ammonite or a Moabite would be allowed in the court. And yet Eliashib, the priest, had allowed Tobiah to be there and to store his belongings there in the court of the Lord. Now, that's an important principle for children of God today to learn as well. That friendship with the world is something that can cause a great deal of conflict when it comes to the point of where you are called upon to obey God. If we have divided loyalties, those divided loyalties can cause us to seek what another desires rather than our God. And there are any number of examples and warnings that are given with regard to this. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 is one example in verses 33 and 34 where the Apostle Paul says, "Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. Evil companionship corrupts good morals," as another translation gives it. And he says in verse 34, "Awake to righteousness and do not sin." Now, what was causing the Corinthians on this particular occasion not to live as righteously as they should? It was a divided loyalty. It was the companions that they were keeping. Young people, I cannot emphasize to too great an extent how important a lesson this is to learn, for you to learn while you are young, that evil companions can lead you on the road to ruin. There are any number of proverbs, where the writer of the book of Proverbs, this wise man, warns his son about the dangers of walking in the paths of the wicked, of following a fool in his errand, of doing the things that the worldly want to do. It leads to ruin. And a righteous individual should be careful to keep himself pure and to stay away from those corrupting influences. Choose your companions carefully, lest they lead you astray. Had the same attitude that David had in Psalm 26. In this Psalm of David, beginning in verse 24 of the 26th Psalm. Excuse me, verse 4 of that Psalm. Psalm 26, verse 4, David wrote this. He said, "I have not sat with idolatrous mortals, nor will I go in with hypocrites. I have hated the assembly of evildoers, and I will not sit with the wicked. I will wash my hands in innocence, and I will go about your altar, O Lord, that I may proclaim with the voice of thanksgiving, tell of all your wondrous works." That's the decision he made. I want you to understand how important it is to make that decision. I am not going to sully myself with these influences, these divided loyalties. I'm not going to allow these individuals to corrupt me. I'm going to stay away from them. I'm not going to allow myself to be influenced by them. I'm not going to sit with them. I'm not going to go into them. I'm going to hate to be in the presence of evildoers. Instead, I'm going to turn myself to a righteous life and to righteous considerations. Now, we live in a society that is decidedly anti-religious, decidedly ungodly. That is the way of the world. As a result of that, if we have children, for example, or adults who have jobs that they go to, it is necessary for you to be in the presence of those who are ungodly. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapters 5 and 6, the Apostle Paul deals with that, talking about how the fact that you cannot come out of the world, you're in the world, but you are not, in effect, to be of the world. You're to be different. You should not allow yourself to gain any alliance that will lead you to or even tempt you to lose your faithfulness to the Almighty God of heaven. So that's one thing for us to take into consideration. The second thing we want to note about had to do with this violation of the Sabbath day. And want to note the fact that if God has set aside a day for some kind of observance, that day is an important thing. It is important to observe that day. The failure to observe the Sabbath day, as again mentioned in the text, Nehemiah chapter 13 and verses 17 and 18, he said, "What evil thing is this that you do by which you profane the Sabbath day? Well, that's something that was so serious that early on in the history of Israel, individuals were actually put to death as a result of it. You remember in Numbers chapter 15 where God instructed Moses to put to death a man who had been picking up sticks on the Sabbath day? That was considered a capital offense, a capital crime, because he picked up sticks and did work on the Sabbath day. In Exodus chapter 20, when the giving of the Ten Commandments is recorded in that particular text in verse 8, he said that we are to remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor, do all work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. It was something that was compelled upon all Jews as they lived under that Mosaic law. And it was something that was, again, even punishable to death. What is a day that God has given us to observe as Christians? Is there a parallel that we can use to correlate with this violation of the Sabbath day? And I think certainly that there is. Because there is a day that has been set aside, for example, for the observance of the Lord's Supper. God has given Christians a specific day that He wants us to come together for the purpose of worshiping Him. We ought to respect Him by presenting ourselves in the assembly for worship and for edification. You know, again, one of the things that is being done with regard to making these changes in our morning as assembly is in the hopes that individuals who otherwise may not be able to come to both of the services or to spend the entirety of the time that we traditionally have spent, those 3 hours that we spend on the Lord's Day for the worship and for the study, that they will be able and be willing to then do that and come together to hear sermons preached, to sing songs. It was a wonderful first worship that we had at 9 o'clock this morning. We had an opportunity. We've been trying to figure out, if we have 20 minutes of singing before I get up to preach, how many songs is that going to be? We got to sing 6 songs right in a row this morning. It was a wonderful period of worship, and there was time for one more. And so, depending upon how fast or slow the song leader is next week, maybe we can sing 7 songs before the preaching begins. A wonderful opportunity we have to worship God. We're coming together for that purpose. Do we have the same respect for the Lord's Day that the Jews were to have for the Sabbath? And I'm not talking about work, because there is not a prescription against work on the first day of the week as it was under the old law, but I'm saying that God has given us instructions to assemble together. In Hebrews chapter 10, you'll remember in verses 24 and 25, He said, "Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works." And that's what we're coming together for. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. We ought to have that same respect for the Sabbath, and perhaps we need to examine our hearts to ensure that we are not seriously disappointing God because we do not show that proper respect for what God has given us to do on His day. Third point. The marrying of pagan wives. This is an interesting thing. In Nehemiah 13 and verse 23, he said, "In those days I saw Jews had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab." And then he gives Solomon as a type of cautionary tale in this regard. I would like to take your minds back to 1 Kings chapter 10. 1 Kings chapter 10. I want you to note verses 1 through 4 of that book. 1 Kings 10, 1 through 4. We're told King Solomon loved many foreign women. Something wrong with that. And again, an indication that it is a violation of the principle established from the beginning when a man, God gave a woman to a man, and the two of them should become one flesh. But King Solomon, he loved many women. Foreign women. The daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, the Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, "You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you." Why? Why were they not to intermarry? "Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods." That was the reason why God would not allow the Israelites to intermarry with the pagans around them, because it would turn their hearts after their gods. But Solomon didn't heed it. He clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. So it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. So is there an application? Well, there certainly is. Young people, something I would like you to consider carefully again. Those of you who have not yet married, those of you who are looking to find someone to spend your life with, understand the importance of marrying someone who will not turn your heart away from the Lord. Someone who, instead of being an impediment, a stumbling stone put in your path, will be someone who will help you get to heaven. Now, at times such as these, often a preacher will read from 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. You remember the apostle's words? He says, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness?" Now, in stating that, I do want to hasten to say that the context of 2 Corinthians 6 is not dealing with the subject of marriage. In fact, in the 7th chapter, where he is dealing specifically with marriage, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the call is, when one is married to a Christian, to remain with them. And so we're not saying that we need to divorce any individual who's not a Christian that we're married to. That's not the point that is being made. What is being made is the point that if you have alliances with individuals who turn your heart away from God, that unfaithfulness will cost you your soul. If there is some yoking together, which is an unequal yoking, what that means is you are now in a situation to where you are not serving God acceptably because of the influence, because of your perceived obligations toward, or because of some impediment that comes as a result of that yoking. It's an unequal yoking that you need not have. Now, what does that mean for someone who is already married to a non-Christian? Don't allow that influence to be that rock of offense. If you're already married to someone who is not a Christian, you understand how difficult it is to remain faithful. How difficult it is to bring your children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Perhaps you've learned those lessons the hard way. Do not let that be a yoking that will lead you to lose your soul. But young people, if you've not yet married, be careful. Recognize how dangerous it is to marry someone who we might would consider a pagan in the sense that they're not Christians, they're not interested in the things of God. To cultivate a relationship with an individual that if you marry them will not help you get to heaven. And the admonition is an appropriate one. It is one that needs to be heeded by those who are of an age to marry those who one day will marry. The closest of ties being something that could actually lead you to destruction, rather than being that helpmeet who will enable you in the walk, the path that you take to strive to get to heaven. Be careful about that. The admonition is certainly needed today. The final point that we want to make with regard to this is looking at the pattern of Nehemiah as he did these things, these positive things. He appealed to God's mercy. Chapter 31 of Nehemiah 13, "Remember me, O my God, for good." Chapter 13, verse 22, when he was protecting the holiness of the Sabbath day, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of your mercy." Nehemiah was grieved at the sin of the people. It bothered him so much that now that we've had an opportunity to go back to the city of Jerusalem, God is allowing us to return to the land. God has softened the heart of the king of Persia to allow us to rebuild the walls and to gain a portion of sovereignty that we once enjoyed. And now you see the people there, they're transgressing God's commandment. It angered him. He understood the importance of humbling themselves before God, of being penitent and sorrowful for those transgressions. And as he made his petition to God, he said, "Please remember me. Be merciful for me. I'm trying to do your will." And understand this. We may all the day long ask for God's mercy, but we cannot expect to attain the mercy of God unless we humble ourselves and repent. Unless we have a penitent heart, a heart that is desirous of service. He was presenting these things, these fruits of his efforts, as evidence that his heart was pure, that he had humbled himself, that he was wanting to serve God and was hoping that God would extend his mercy in that regard. It reminds me of the text of James chapter 4 and verse 6, where we are told that God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And there is the call for us to submit ourselves to God, to resist the devil, and he will flee from us. As a part of that, it's what we do. We draw near to God, cleanse our hands, purify our hearts, lament and mourn and weep. Let our laughter be turned to mourning and our joy to gloom. Humble ourselves in the sight of God with the promise that if we do that, he will lift us up. That's the promise. You cannot expect to attain God's mercy unless you humble yourself and you are obedient to him. Consider the zeal of Nehemiah. Consider the ardor that led him to these strong reactions against sin and a willingness to strongly oppose that and to really compel the people to serve him acceptably. And recognize that in every place and at every time, God demands that we humble ourselves as well. That we live righteously just as Nehemiah did. And so we ask that question, what about you? Do you have that same ardor, that same enthusiasm and zeal? Is that expressed by Nehemiah in this particular chapter? We hope and pray that you do. There is something that is lacking there, then we call upon you to return to your first love. We call upon you to understand the importance of resisting sin and seeking to compel individuals to live righteously. To regain that enthusiasm and compel that enthusiasm in others that we all may please him. Because we are given that promise that Jesus, having become perfected, that he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey. Nehemiah wanted Judah to obey God. It is my prayer that each and every one of us today will establish ourselves in that and that we will feel compelled to obey him as well. And so we offer our invitation this morning to any who is here. If you are here and you're not a child of God, you need to become one today. Don't wait until tomorrow because you don't have the hope of tomorrow. If you are not living right, if there is some lack of zeal, if there is some apostasy that is present, some digression in your life, steel yourself, turn around, humble yourself before God and come to repentance. We'll pray for you. We'll help you in any way we possibly can. The invitation is extended at this time to all who are here. If you have that need, we ask that you come while together we stand and while we sing the song selected.